Zora Neale Hurston wore slacks in the 1920s, smoked cigarettes in public, and had an interest in voodoo and zombies. Until her death in 1960, the author of Their Eyes Were Watching God and Mules and Men wore many hats: fiction writer, poet, playwright, anthropologist, folklorist, and journalist. An influential player in the Harlem Renaissance, Hurston lamented lost opportunities for the artistic expression of African Americans. She said she wanted to appease her ancestors by serving as their loudspeaker. Hurston's niece, Lucy Ann Hurston, has written a book called Speak So You Can Speak Again, The Life of Zora Neale Hurston. It's the first book about her to be sanctioned by her estate. Lucy Ann Hurston is in the studios of Producers 2 in Hartford, Connecticut. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Where does the title Speak So You Can Speak Again come from?
The book had several titles before it actually was put on paper, but I think because of the way we've put the book together as like a memory book with materials inside of it that through all of these different ways people can hear Zora speak, literally with her voice in the CD that's included and through the material objects that we've included in her own handwriting.
The material objects, I mean, there are reproductions of Christmas cards that she used to send, drafts of poems, letters in her handwriting. It's like a little museum between these hard covers. How did you go about putting it together, you know, getting the reproductions to look so much like the originals?
I just thought it would be wonderful if everyone could have a little piece of Zora so that we could make like a memory box out of these things that I had shown to other people that I had used at public speaking engagements. And it would be another way that people could own a piece of Zora.
Hmm. So many personal details in this book. I mean, she published her first short story in Howard University's literary magazine in May 1921, and she even gave the university newspaper its name, The Hilltop. How was it that she was able to make her way from being a penniless housekeeper to get to Howard University and then to Barnard and then to Columbia?
She had a way about her. She could convince people of things, to give up things, to give her things. And I think more times than not, just the fact that she asked, being black, being female, that just the fact that she had the audacity to ask locked people back on their heels.
I was impressed with her tenacity about her education. I mean, you know, she wasn't someone who went through college in 4 years. I mean, she worked hard to put herself through, and it took a long time, but she never gave up.
Right. She saw the importance of it. It shaped the way she saw the world. She was, I think, more an anthropologist than anything else.
The book, there's a sleeve on the front cover, and there's a CD of Zora Neale Hurston speaking about her life. She's even selections of her singing. We have a clip here from a 1943 radio interview, and here she's telling the interviewer, Mary Margaret McBride, what it means to put your foot up.
You go to the house and you put your foot up on the step, you see, and one hand in your hip, and then you really tell them what you think about them and all the folks way back for five or six generations. And maybe like the old man was a double hump camel and the mom was a mule. Telling all about it.
Wonderful to hear her voice and her command of the vernacular. I think even Henry Louis Gates praised her for that command of the black vernacular tradition. I mean, she wrote about a culture that she had left behind. But this writing made her a famous New York intellectual. And you write about it too. Some critics accused her of, and this is the quote, cooning for white folk. Is this something that she constantly struggled with?
She did. I think it was the idea that those things that came out of the black culture were innately inferior was the thing that infuriated her. She believed in the diversity of populations and that things didn't necessarily have to be ranked up against or measured up against that which came from the white community. And that was, I think, the impetus behind the collection of the African-American vernacular that she worked her entire career on. And it's really a reflection of the fact that she grew up in black Eatonville. And I think the thing that they missed was that she was raised, she was socialized into seeing those things that were uniquely and exclusively black as normal and good and right and proper and beautiful. They had not been, and they had been tainted by distortions of believing in their own inferiority as told to them by whites.
Hmm. Eatonville was a formed black community, right?
The very first all-black incorporated town in America.
When she went back to Florida to gather folklore material, the folks in her hometown, they didn't trust her. She said, "We let the probe enter, but it never comes out. It gets smothered under a lot of laughter and pleasantries." And she described her hometown as a featherbed of resistance. Elaborate on that term. What did it mean, a featherbed of resistance?
I think that it was warm and comforting and inviting, but that you really knew, never knew what was much underneath that. They didn't know how to take Zora. I think they guarded what they had about their community because it had previously been held up to ridicule. And you could even look at it and say it's a control issue, that they wanted to keep what was theirs.
Hmm.
So they were leery about the fact that she could, in fact, dance between these two worlds.
Hmm. I didn't know until I read your book that she was falsely accused of molesting a mentally retarded 10-year-old boy in 1948. What effect did this false accusation have on her and her work and her career?
This was probably one of the most devastating things that happened to Zora during her life. When these false charges were brought out, it was predominantly the black press that loved holding her up to ridicule, and they were the first and the loudest voices about the incident. But the black press never did a retraction. They never cleared her name, and she felt very much sold out by her own. And I think it's something that just crushed her.
Hmm.
She had difficulty getting published after that. Manuscripts that she had in progress, work that she had in progress, everything was halted. And her entire life was about this creative force. And now it was stumped.
On page 32 of the book, there's a picture of a young girl in a First Communion dress. Is that you?
It is. It is. That is on the front lawn of our house in Brooklyn, New York. That's my daddy and I. You know, I was 3 when she passed, and I'm told that I met her once, but I have no firsthand recollection. What I do have is 30 years of my father telling me about his big sister.
Is there a story your father used to tell you about his big sister?
Well, one of the stories was about her unpredictability. And he claims that they had a place together on Central Park West for a while, and they could only afford that apartment with both of them there, with both of them working and splitting the rent. And she left, and I believe it was for milk or to run some type of, brief errand, and he didn't see her for days. And then when next he heard from her, she was in Haiti, and he was being evicted. She'd do what she needed to do, and then she'd fade back into people's lives. And I know that my father said that one time when he was in the hospital in Chicago and ill, that he doesn't know how she found out or where she was. He hadn't seen her in a while, and she just showed up.
Her books were out of print before she died in 1960, and it was the author Alice Walker who began to revive the public interest. Today, Zora Neale Hurston's fiction is taught widely. I mean, not only in literature classes, but in black studies courses and in women's courses. Do you think she considered herself an academic, or did she think of herself as an artist?
I think both. She had the ability to use both sides of the brain, so to speak. But I think she saw herself very much as a technician of the social sciences. What's important is that she's read not as a marginalized group today. She's not read on the fringes, but she's read mainstream. You read Hemingway, you read Faulkner, you read Hurston.
Lucy Ann Hurston. Lucy Ann Hurston's book, Speak So You Can Speak Again, chronicles the life of her aunt, author Zora Neale Hurston. Lucy Ann Hurston joined us from the Producers 2 studios in Hartford, Connecticut. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
That Old Black Gal is a spiking song that I got down there in Miami and was sung by Max Ford, the singing line on this construction crew. Used for spiking down the rails. That old shoes, Lord, a new pair of shoes. I'm going to buy her shoes and stockings, slippers too, Lord, slippers too. Says to Lord, give
Yes, that's true.
A railroad work song sung by Zora Neale Hurston from a recording included with Lucy Ann Hurston's book, Speak So You Can Speak Again. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen.